The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. Let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
My name is John Shuck, and this is The Beloved Community. It's a live program in which we explore issues of spirituality, social justice, and all kinds of other things, things that I hope matter. And I have a guest who matters. He's written a number of books. Daniel Kovalik is Senior Associate General Counsel of the United Steelworkers, AFL-CIO. He's worked for the USW, the United Steelworkers, since graduating from Columbia Law School in 1993. And while with the USW, he served as lead counsel on cutting-edge labor law litigation, including the landmark cases of Le Mans Gasket and specialty health care. He's worked on Alien Tort Claims Act cases against Coca-Cola, Drummond, and Occidental Petroleum, cases arising out of egregious human rights abuses in Colombia. The Christian Science Monitor refers to his work defending Colombian unionists under the threat of assassination, recently described Mr. Kovalik as one of the most prominent defenders of Colombian workers in the United States. Mr. Kovalik received the David W. Mills Mentoring Fellowship from the Stanford University School of Law and was the recipient of the Project Censored Award for his article exposing the unprecedented killing of trade unionists in Colombia. He's written extensively on the issue of international human rights and U.S. foreign policy for the Huffington Post and Counterpunch, and has lectured throughout the world on these subjects. The book that he has completed in the fall of 2018 is about Iran and the United States. It's called The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Dan Kovalik, I believe I just heard you're in Nicaragua. Welcome to the Beloved Community.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I am in Managua, Nicaragua.
All right. Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today. The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Why did you write this book, and what do you want to communicate with it?
I, along with a lot of other people, are afraid that Iran is on the short list for the next war that the U.S. wants to wage. John Bolton, who's Donald Trump's national security advisor, has been very open about the fact that he wants to attack Iran. Mike Pompeo, who's Secretary of State, has also made such statements. And as I talk about a lot in the book, and I cite retired Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson for this proposition, a war with Iran would just be absolutely devastating, both for Iran and the United States. And so I wrote the book after traveling to Iran, by the way, in 2017, to try to prevent the next war.
Trump, now this is just within the last week, labeled the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, as a terrorist organization. Now, you didn't write about this necessarily in the book, but can you talk a little bit about that? What is the IRGC, and what does that mean for Trump to call it a terrorist organization? I mean, is this really a declaration, in a sense, of war on Iran, thinking that we're having this global war on terror, or could it be perceived as such?
Yeah, so... what you're referring to is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is the military of Iran since 1979, since Iran had its revolution. And as I note in the book, Nicaragua had its revolution the same year, 1979. Both countries overthrew U.S.-backed dictators that year. And as we know, Iran became an Islamic republic, and they formed the Revolutionary Guard. So it's essentially their military. And yes, to claim that their entire military is a terrorist organization is, in essence, a declaration of war. Of course, it's an ironic claim because whatever you say about Iran and the Revolutionary Guard, they actually do a lot to fight al-Qaeda and ISIS. In the Middle East, they've been very critical in doing so in Syria, for example, and in Iraq. And a lot of, you know, once in a while you'll see a mainstream source that acknowledges that, but often that's overlooked. People also forget that after 9/11, Iran immediately offered to help the U.S. Fight al-Qaeda and to take on the Taliban in Afghanistan. And Iran, in fact, did provide such help. So again, there's an irony here to throw around labels like terrorism when referring to Iran, when in fact they've been very willing partners in the fight against terror. And in fact, Iran was very disappointed after offering considerable help after 9/11 for the war on terror. They thought there would be a reboot of U.S.-Iranian relations. And in fact, the opposite happened. You might recall that George Bush would then, after receiving help from Iran, would then label it as part of the axis of evil, this imaginary axis of evil, and really set back Iranian-U.S. relations at that point. And so here we are in 2019, and which, by the way, is the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution against the Shah of Iran, which the U.S. installed. And the U.S. seems very hell-bent on possibly going to war with this country.
Dan Kovalik is my guest, if you're just joining us on The Beloved Community. His book is The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran, and certainly calling people terrorists is a way to vilify them. And it's, as you mentioned, it's a confusion on it's kind of lumping everyone together. So what role does Islamophobia play in all of this vilification?
Well, I think it plays a lot. I mean, first of all, it obscures the fact that as in Christianity, for example, as in Judaism, you know, there are Muslims and then there's Muslims. There's different type of Muslims.
Right.
There's different type of people who follow that faith. It's a huge faith, you know. And again, to lump in Iran, which is a Shia Islamic state, with, for example, Iraq, which is, well, had been mostly Sunni. Now it is a Shia state after the U.S., of course, invaded in 2003. But to liken them with the folks like Osama bin Laden, for example, who follows a very extreme and, in fact, heretical form of Islamicism called Wahhabism, it really obscures the difference between those folks. And in fact, that, again, the truth is that Iran has been the mortal enemy of Wahhabism, of bin Laden, of al-Qaeda for many years, as was Muammar Gaddafi, as was Saddam Hussein. And again, there's a huge irony that while we were attacked by al-Qaeda on 9/11, the countries we ended up targeting after 9/11 have been countries, by and large, that have been against al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And in fact, we've done a lot to empower al-Qaeda. And in the recent article I saw was that our own intelligence estimates believe that al-Qaeda, groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS, are bigger and stronger now than they were before 9/11. And largely because of the U.S., role in the Middle East, because of its partnership with Saudi Arabia, which is the font of terrorism in the Middle East, which played a role in 9/11, as the 9/11 Congressional Commission found. But instead of going after Saudi Arabia, we partnered with them against countries that actually wanted to take al-Qaeda down. It's a very strange and sordid story, which again, people are intentionally misled about.
You know, when I was this past fall in Iraq for Arba'in, the Shia pilgrimage to the grandson of the Prophet Hussein, and while I was there, I really didn't know about this very much before until, but I learned the story that it is really the Iraqis and led by the fatwa of the actually defeat ISIS. So really, it is on that aspect, and I probably met hundreds of Iranians, also a part of this too, that that really the resistance to ISIS and the terrorist group comes from, in a sense, the Shia Islam.
Yes, exactly. Although it's a dispute, again, ironically, which the Western powers, including the U.S. and Great Britain, have really tried to intensify. That is to say that, you know, for many, many years, these Shia Islam and Sunni Islam live, you know, they existed side by side peacefully. And it's actually the Western powers that have tried to play one country off another, one faith against another, one sect against another, to rule the Middle East. And with the result being a lot of the conflicts that we're seeing. We've tended to reap a whirlwind from these types of manipulations abroad, and we're seeing that right now.
I am speaking with Dan Kovalik. He is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. And I want to talk with you, Dan, about your trip to Iran in 2017. But before I even do that, give us a 60-second, if you would, soundbite about the book I have not read, but I have, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia.
Yeah, well, I wrote that book now almost 2 years ago, and as the name suggests, it really is in response to the so-called Russiagate scandal, and my belief, I think it's backed up by facts and history, that Russia is not the U.S.'s enemy, and that Russia, in fact, very much like Iran, has extended the offer to the U.S., again, including after 9/11. Vladimir Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush to offer condolences, to offer with help in Afghanistan. And in fact, he did offer that help. And as you can imagine, Russia had a lot of assets in Afghanistan because of the long Afghan war. And again, Putin helped the U.S. considerably in the war on terror. And again, and then was sad to then learned that the U.S. would not reciprocate, and that in fact it now has with NATO troops up to the Russian frontier. We're now in a state where we're looking at possible conflict with Russia now, and with Trump backing out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Missile Treaty of 1987, we're in a very dangerous moment with Russia. And again, as I argue vociferously in the book, we're at a we have tensions that are not necessary, don't have to be there with a country that wants to be our friend.
Well, and this whole thing about the Russiagate was that Putin and Trump were like together, but Trump has been very aggressive against Russia. I mean, that doesn't even make sense.
Well, that is the irony, isn't it? And that's something that the pundits really can't explain to you, that Trump has imposed sanctions against Russia, again, has actually increase the NATO presence in Europe on the borders of Russia, has backed out of this long-standing nuclear missile deal. For a guy who's supposed to be in cahoots with Putin and Russia, he is quite aggressive against them. Now, of course, you know, part of what I think happened, and I think it was a horrible mistake, and other people like Stephen F. Cohen have talked about this. I mean, that the Russiagate scandal in many ways probably pushed Trump to be more aggressive against Russia than he otherwise would have wanted to. And I think that that's a tragedy. I think that, again, there's a lot of common ground we have with Russia. And it's a shame that this Russiagate, which has turned out, in my view, to be a nothing burger, has really changed the relationship between those two countries.
I'm speaking with Dan Kovalik on the Beloved Community, author of a number of books. We're talking chiefly about the plot to attack Iran, how the CIA and the deep state have conspired to vilify Iran. And you went to Iran in July 2017. You write about that in your book. My question is, did you have some misconceptions about Iran that were overturned by your visit? Or maybe talk about some of those misconceptions that American people have about Iran.
Well, I think, first of all, people might think that, you know, that women, for example, are walking around with long black robes and burqas that cover their face. And it's not true. Largely speaking, women have very light head covering and wear very modern clothes and actually are very well represented in every sector of Iranian society. In politics and in the economy. In many ways, Iran is very advanced when compared to its neighbors in terms of women's rights. And it's a very modern country in many ways. Again, it is not doesn't have this feel of some type of theocratic dictatorship. It's a beautiful country, and the irony is that people are very friendly to you, especially when they find out you're an American. Iranians love Americans, and they love to speak English to you. Most Iranians speak some level of English. Almost all the signs are in both Farsi and English. It's a very hospitable place, and you don't have a sense of a country that bears ill will towards certainly the American people. They certainly have some serious grievances against the U.S. government, and quite legitimate grievances.
So why, big question here, why does the United States want to target Iran? I mean, is Iran really a threat to the United States? When you look at the military bases, I mean, Americans surround, military bases surrounding Iran, but I don't see many Iranian military bases surrounding the United States.
Yes, well, and that's true of Russia as well, of course. You can say the very same thing. Yeah, no, Iran obviously is not a threat to the United States. Again, it has offered and has provided help in very important efforts of the U.S. In the Middle East to fight terrorism. It's a country that wants friendship. In fact, again, after 9/11 and after Iran helped with the war on terror, we know that there was a fax sent from the Iranian government to the U.S. State Department with a proposal, very broad proposal, in which Iran put every issue the U.S. had of concern on the table, said they wanted to negotiate these things and have a reset of relationship. And that fax was ignored. And again, Bush then gave his Axis of Evil speech and really set back not only, by the way, Iranian-U.S. relations, but also set back reforms in Iran because the hardliners became preeminent after that Axis of Evil speech. And so, again, there have been many lost opportunities with Iran. Why the U.S. targets it? The main reason, and the main reason it targets Nicaragua to this day, is it both overthrew U.S.-backed dictatorships. And that is an unforgivable sin as far as the U.S. government is concerned, and Iran has not been forgiven for that.
Well, let's go back to that. And one of the big years in the United States-Iran relations was in 1953. Can you give us a brief overview of what happened?
Yeah, so in the early 1950s, Iran was actually moving towards a more democratic society. They had a parliament, which they still do, by the way. The parliaments existed before the 50s and exist today, but it's had various levels of autonomy and power. In the early 50s, they were really becoming a parliamentary democracy. And they had a strong and popular prime minister, popularly elected, named Mohammad Mossadegh, who, because his parliament wanted it, and he wanted it, and the people wanted it, nationalized Iran's own oil fields, which up to that point had been controlled by the British. And almost all the profits from Iran's oil were going to the British, while about 90% of the population was living in misery. Obviously, this was unacceptable. And Mossadegh nationalized Iran's own oil and offered compensation. But that was not enough. And so Britain first wanted to overthrow Mossadegh, but didn't have the power at that point and didn't have the assets in Iran because a lot of their folks were thrown out by Mossadegh. And so Britain came to the U.S. and asked them to help overthrow this democratically elected prime minister. And that's what happened. The U.S. supported a coup against Mossadegh. They installed the Shah of Iran, who was a monarch, who at that point was really being sidelined. His days were over as the reigning monarch because of the parliamentary democracy. The U.S., ironically, in the name of democracy, reinstalled the king as the premier leader of the country, overthrew Mossadegh, helped create something called the SAVAK, which was the Iranian security apparatus, which had its tentacles throughout society. It was very much like the Stasi in East Germany. And it ruled through terror, and it ruled through torture. And in fact, in 1977, a couple of years before the revolution, Amnesty International concluded that U.S.-backed Iran had the very worst human rights record on Earth. And so this is really the font of Iran's grievance with the U.S., that we interfered in their democratic development, in their economic development, with their cultural development. And then when they had a popular revolution in 1979, the U.S. moved very quickly to undermine Iran, to support Saddam Hussein in attacking Iran. This led to the 8 years war between Iran and Iraq, in which a million people died, in which, with U.S. help, Iraq used chemical weapons against the Iranian people and against his own people, particularly the Kurds. And by the way, Iran never retaliated in kind.
Yeah.
The Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa saying that chemical weapons and nuclear weapons are against Islam.
Dan Kovalik, author of The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. So let's go back to 1979. I was in high school during the Islamic Revolution, watching Ted Koppel every night regarding the hostages. So did American media tell us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth regarding what was happening there and then?
No, not at all. And in fact, you know, for the American people, the Islamic Revolution came as a shock. And why? Because they had no understanding of who the Shah was at that time, who was in power, and the fact the U.S. installed the Shah. They had no idea about his brutality. They have no idea about it, you know, to this day, for the most part. And so they didn't understand why the Iranian people overthrew the Shah. They didn't understand why the Iranian people, or some Iranian people in the Iranian government, expressed antipathy towards the U.S. at that time. And they did so because the U.S. backed the Shah unto the bitter end, even as it was pretty clear he was going to be toppled. The U.S. continued to support him and his military in attacking the people. And what they also didn't understand is why the hostage crisis began, and that was in reaction to the fact that not only did the U.S. and Jimmy Carter back the Shah until the 11th hour, but even after the revolution, Jimmy Carter invited the Shah to live in the United States, and the Iranian people, the last time that the Shah had left Iran for the United States, he was brought back. He was brought into power by the U.S., and that was in 1953. They feared the same thing was going to happen again, and that is why they took the hostages. Interestingly, they let go every person of color who were amongst the hostages and the women. And at first, by the way, it was hostage taking was done really spontaneously by a group of students, though ultimately the Iranian government did support that. But the other fascinating aspect of it was that in the last months, the true captor of those hostages was not the Ayatollah Khomeini or Iranian students. It was Ronald Reagan, who we know went behind Jimmy Carter's back in order to try to win the 1976 election and used old assets that the CIA had under the Shah to make contact with the hostage takers. And they made a deal for the hostages to be kept through the 1976 election so that Carter would lose that election. And you may recall, and I recall it very...
You mean the 1980 election?
I'm a bit young. But, yeah, I'm sorry, the 1980 yeah. election, you're right. I remember quite vividly, because I was young, and I was 12 years old, but I remember vividly that the hostages were released within minutes of Ronald Reagan's inauguration in January of 1981. And at the time, you know, it was portrayed, oh, this was, you know, Reagan's magic. Look at this. He hasn't been president but for a few minutes and the hostages are released. Well, it turned out, no, that he was part of keeping them held hostage so that he could prevail in the 1980 election. And again, the irony there, you talk about election meddling. How can you conceive of a worse and more reprehensible way to win an election than to have your own citizens kept in captivity longer to embarrass the current standing president at that time, Jimmy Carter?
I'm speaking with Dan Kovalik. He's the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Of course, one of the big bugaboos is about Iran developing nuclear weapons. And when I was there, and you mentioned it too in your book, I saw also affirm that Islamic law really forbids weapons of mass destruction. You mentioned the chemical weapons as well as nuclear weapons. Is there a reason not to trust Iran's leadership regarding nuclear weapons?
Well, there isn't a reason to distrust them. And frankly, our own intelligence estimates concluded, I think, back in 2003, that Iran, even whether it ever wanted nuclear weapons, that it had abandoned any of those hopes back in 2003. And again, the UN has certified that Iran is not trying to develop nuclear weapons. And so that just seems to be a red herring, and also particularly because, by the way, of course, the one country in the Middle East that does have nuclear weapons is Israel, and it may have 100 of them or 200. We don't even know, but we know they do have nuclear weapons, which makes them pretty, you know, bulletproof in terms of any war in the Middle East. Meanwhile, Iran has none, and so this fear of Iran and nuclear weapons, it's not real. It's made up, and it's not even a real fear.
You mentioned Israel. Some have suggested that much of the U.S. involvement in the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Iran, is on behalf of Israel, that the U.S. is destabilizing the Middle East on behalf of Israel for its expansion and hegemony. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it is certainly a major consideration, absolutely. And we see in Syria, of course, that Donald Trump has recognized Israel's claim to the Golan Heights, even though the UN does not recognize that. Syria does not recognize it. Clearly, the U.S., their main focus in the Middle East is to not only support Israel, but as you say, to help it expand beyond the borders it even has now. And of course, we see what's happening in Palestine with Israel continuing to take more and more land there and leaving very little left for the Palestinian people, and all of that being done with the support of the United States. And yes, so Israel is a huge motivation for the U.S. relations. And again, when you talk about meddling in U.S. politics, I mean, there's no country that has more sway over U.S. politics than Israel through AIPAC, for example. And you see after every election, every midterm election, the you know, scores of U.S. Congress people being flown to Israel in order to get their support for Israel. So, you know, that is something we need to take a look at. And, yes, obviously that's a main concern. The other concern, of course, is the U.S. wanting control over the Middle East resources, the oil, which has always been a motivation for the United States.
Dan Kovalik, my guest, author of The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Also, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. And he talked about that a little bit with Russiagate. The third book I also want to mention here is The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcomes of Elections Around the World. And, of course, you yourself, certainly in Central America, know a lot about this. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yes, and that was written, again, in response a lot to this concern about alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. elections. And as I argue in the book, even if we took everything as true that's being claimed about Russia, it pales in comparison to how the U.S. has meddled in other countries' elections and democratic institutions. Indeed, there's a recent Oxford University study that shows that the U.S. has meddled in at least 81 different elections since World War II.
81.
And that doesn't even count the coup d'etats and the forced overthrows that the U.S. has sponsored since that time. So it's really incredible. And interestingly, and as the book details, it's not just adversary countries that the U.S. has done that to. It's done it in Israel. It's done it in Italy. It's done it in Greece. It's done it in Japan. The U.S. Really has allows very few countries in the world to operate and function politically without our interference.
And tell me about in the beginning of your book, you talk about some of your sources. This is back to the Iran book, are recently declassified documents. What are these documents, and what did you find in them?
Yeah, well, in the Iran book, I do rely heavily on declassified documents that the CIA recently declassified, which focus in particular on the CIA's efforts to overthrow Mossadegh in the years 1952 to 53. These are documents that, first of all, the CIA claimed didn't exist, claimed that they were destroyed at some point, which ended up not being true, and they released them, and they show really the cynicism of the U.S. in intervening in Iran. While it publicly claimed it was there to fight communism, you know, to fight a communist threat that did not exist in Iran, and while it claimed it was there to promote democracy, in fact, it was doing just the opposite, promoting a monarchy. And when you look at the documents and you look at the conversations that the actors are having with each other, those people involved in the coup, you see how cynical they are. You also see the methods they use, and Iran was the first CIA coup, and you see the methods used then are the same methods that the U.S. uses now to overthrow a foreign government. Economic strangulation, supporting violent protests, even paying violent protesters to create chaos, politically isolating the country, vilifying the leader, many times based on misinformation. All these things were used to overthrow Mossadegh, and all those things are used in the U.S.'s campaign now against Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela.
Yeah, so I was just going to
Daniel Ortega here in
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua.
speaking with Dan Kovalik. He is actually in Managua, Nicaragua right now. And Dan, we just got about 2 minutes left, so I want to wrap us up here with what's most important here. Are we closer now to a war really with Iran than when you published your book in 2018? And what do you hope American people will do?
Yeah, I think we are closer to a war with Iran. We've been hearing more and more whisperings about a possible attack on Iran. And people need to resist it. As Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who helped lie us into the war in Iraq, and he's admitted this and he feels bad about it, as he has warned us, a war in Iran would be 10 times more costly than the war with Iraq, in terms of blood and treasure. So you're talking about millions of deaths, trillions of dollars. It's a war that we have to stop, we have to prevent. And what people need to do is rebuild the peace movement. You know, we've had such a long history of peace movements, marches, rallies, which we haven't seen really since the run-up to the war with Iraq in 2003. And folks need to activate the peace movement again. They need to realize that all the money, billions and billions, trillions of dollars we spend on these wars, every dollar of that is a dollar that doesn't go to health care, it doesn't go to alleviate poverty, it doesn't go to repair our bridges and roads in this country. They have to realize if they care about the environment, the U.S. military creates more CO2 than any single country on Earth. Think about that. We need to realize that the font of many of our problems in this country, including, frankly, our spiritual shortcomings, are because we are a country eternally at war. We are the only empire that has ever existed. We're the biggest empire that's ever existed, but the only empire that has ever existed that won't admit to itself it's an empire.
Wow. Dan, we're going to have to end it right there. Dan Kovalik, my guest, author of The Plot to Attack Iran, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Iran. Check out Dan. Dan, do you have a website?
I don't, but you can find me on Counterpunch. And again, the best way to learn about me is to read my books. And I have a new one on Venezuela coming out.
All right.
Also, and it's, of course, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela.
All right. Looking forward to that. I'm John Schuck. This is The Beloved Community, every second Friday at 9 a.m. Be well.